Welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. The keynote speaker for MTSU's celebration of Black History Month is Dr. Cleveland Sellers, president of Voorhees College in Denmark, South Carolina. Dr. Sellers is a veteran of the civil rights movement. In 1968, he participated in a protest which became known as the Orangeburg Massacre after three students were killed and 27 people were injured. He served 7 months in prison for inciting a riot but was pardoned 25 years later. Sellers has served as head of Historically Black Voorhees College since June 2012. He will speak on the theme of A Voice from the Movement at 6 p.m. February 17th in the Honors Building Auditorium. We'll begin our discussion after these words from MTSUnews.com.
Here are some of the stories now on MTSUnews.com, the university's news and information website. The latest MTSU poll shows 55% of respondents disapprove of the job President Barack Obama is doing, while only 30% approve. MTSU alumnus and multi-award-winning songwriter Luke Laird received kudos at the 2014 Grammy Awards January 26th when an album he co-produced, Kacey Musgraves' Same Trailer, Different Park, won the Grammy for Best Country Album. Laird also co-wrote six of the album's 12 tracks, including three with co-producer Shane McAnally. And the lush island nation often called the Crossroads of the Pacific is the destination for a new faculty-led MTSU Study Abroad excursion. MTSU's first-ever 10-day program in Fiji is scheduled for May 22nd through 31st. The course is titled Cross-Cultural Perspectives in Leisure and Tourism. For MTSU News at any time, go to mtsunews.com.
Now over the telephone from Denmark, South Carolina, is Dr. Cleveland Sellers. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Sellers.
Enjoy having this opportunity to speak with you.
I had the privilege of interviewing the late David Halberstam when his book The Children came out, which chronicled the civil rights activism of Diane Nash, James Lawson, and some other college students in the Nashville area. You left Howard University after a year to join the movement. Talk about that decision and what led to it and how your parents felt about it.
That consciousness and excitement for me started with the lynching of Emmett Till in 1955. And the thing that stuck out in my mind was the fact that Emmett Till was around my same age. He might have been just a little bit older than I was, but he was 13 years old, had gone to Mississippi because his mother wanted him to be out of Chicago, and he was going to Mississippi to be in a safe, secure environment. She was not didn't think about the fact that going into Mississippi during those times was going to put him in harm's way. A black publication called Jet Magazine, which came into many of our homes, had a picture of his grotesque and distorted head from the brutalization and the wires in his head and all that kind of thing on the front page. And so we had to, I guess that was the point of losing our innocence and recognizing that we had some work that we had to do because we did not think it right that a system would actually allow somebody to murder a young teenager and then exonerate them through a trial where there was no interest in finding justice. So I think at that point we all kind of made a commitment that we had to fight very hard to change the system. And so the students began to plan to test the facilities in a downtown drugstore here in Denmark. And I had the opportunity of working with them to develop the strategy and the tactics that were going to be employed and all that kind of thing. Because I was so young and a high school student who went to high school on the college campus, they would not allow me to go down to the demonstration, but they allowed me to be a part of all of the planning and all of the support that the demonstrators could actually have. So that was my first encounter. And by April of that same year, some 50,000 students had been arrested and been involved in some kind of sit-in or testing of public accommodation facilities across the East Coast and some on the West Coast and places like Chicago and Detroit. So the energy from the students getting involved was an energy that said that the movement was beginning to quicken its pace. The young people wanted to change the leadership in the civil rights movement that would be more inclusive of women and others, and they also wanted to change the tactic and the strategy. The overall strategy was a legal strategy. We called it legalism, in which they would the civil rights movement would go to court and adjudicate, and through that eliminate pockets of discrimination. We thought that process was too long, and we used the Brown versus Board of Education. Charles Hamilton Houston, the lead attorney on this case, started that in 1935, and it was 1954 before the Supreme Court actually rendered a verdict on that. You had to participate, and you had to be willing to suffer whatever sacrifices that you had to make in order for you to move the movement forward and continue to build the struggle for social justice and voting rights and economic opportunities and all those things which were denied people in America merely because they were African American.
We'll be right back. This is MTSU on the record.
The Intercultural and Diversity Affairs Center helps to promote awareness and understanding of the wide variety of cultures represented at MTSU. The center provides information, referrals, and resources. Additionally, IDAC tries to make students from different cultures feel welcome and comfortable on campus so they can have every opportunity to fulfill their academic, social, and personal potential. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're talking with Dr. Cleveland Sellers, president of Voorhees College in Denmark, South Carolina, and the keynote speaker for MTSU's Black History Month celebration. He'll be here February 17th. Now, how did your mother and father feel about this? They must have been proud of you, yet at the same time worried, knowing the danger.
Initially, my parents were concerned, and that concern came up even before I left South Carolina, because it became known that I was one of the people who were involved in developing the strategies and developing the logistics and all that kind of thing to get the demonstrations by the college students at Voorhees College engaged in these demonstrations. So there was economic pressure applied to both my mother and my father, and that created some tension between me and my father as a result of his asking if I would delay some of these activities and not have the same level of associations. I was taken aback by that, and I insisted, but I when I was growing up, we had respect for our parents, and if there was a conflict, the win goes to the adult. So I did have to step down from a youth chapter of the NAACP that I had formed in Denmark and at the college. And so my thing was that at when I graduated, I was going to go off and I was going to kind of tie back into the movement wherever I went. I just happened to have gone to Washington, D.C. and Howard University. And I was there in time to be a part of the planning for the March on Washington by Rustin and A. Philip Randolph and that crew of individuals. Now, I wasn't a civil rights leader, a field secretary, any of that at that point. I was pretty much a gopher, and I ran errands for everybody, but it put me in a position where I could see how organizing was done, and I could learn how to become an organizer to some extent, but to understand the importance of organizing in this movement. So my parents were a little reluctant when I decided to withdraw from Howard and go to Mississippi the summer of 1964. And so they had a difficult time with that. My mother was probably more settled with that than I was, but my father had grown up in South Carolina, so he knew what being targeted by the Klan and targeted by the police and those kind of things could have a detrimental consequences tied to it. So he was a little worried about me being in Mississippi. But he was a proud man, and sometimes he would have difficulty expressing himself. So it took until, I think, about 1968 when he decided to write me a letter and tell me that it was time for me to come home, and that he was there with open arms, and he wanted me to allow some other young people to be engaged in civil rights. And that was the time when I actually found out that it was a question of security, that he was having his issues with my participation. It wasn't that he didn't want me to be engaged in the movement, but he was just concerned about his son being in harm's way all the time. And we had the murder of Shrunna Goodman and Cheney in Mississippi that same summer I went down there. And so our job was to keep moving, that not to allow the violence that we experienced to deter us from continuing to struggle.
We have to pause for a message here, but we'll return shortly. This is MTSU on the Record.
The Experiential Learning Scholars Program at MTSU gives students a chance to go outside the classroom and obtain hands-on experience in their chosen fields of study. They'll have the opportunity to give something back to the community through service learning as they gain acceptance for graduate study. Students should be able to select EXL-designated courses from major requirements and general studies requirements to complete the 16 to 18 hours of EXL coursework. For all of the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
Dr. Cleveland Sellers is our guest today. He'll be MTSU's keynote speaker for Black History Month, February 17th. The Orangeburg Massacre doesn't seem to get very much national attention when people refer to the civil rights movement or the 1960s in general. Why do you think that is?
The Orangeburg Massacre was a simple case of law enforcement coming to the campus and coming onto the campus of South Carolina State at night and opening fire. Nobody has done any investigation of why they opened fire, or what sparked their open fire, or why the people were actually killed. And they opened fire for a period of, and this is State Highway Patrol, they opened fire for at least 8 seconds. They had shotguns and pistols. They had brought weapons from their homes and everywhere else, and they were just shooting. If the FBI and those in authority were really concerned about what had happened and transpired, and certainly the state was not interested in doing anything but making it look like somebody else was to blame, they blamed the victims. They said that you caused the state troopers to open fire on you. But there were no weapons found. There was no anything that showed that there was any firing that came from anywhere but the state troopers that opened fire. All of the state troopers didn't open fire. Just nine, a total of, well, eight state troopers and one local city police. There were National Guards there in the same area that the state troopers were. They didn't even load their weapons because it was not a dangerous situation, but it was cold that night, and the students built a bonfire, and the police decided that they were going to put the bonfire out. And so that's what they were working on when I think a policeman got struck by a piece of wood or something. And they started saying that the policeman had gotten shot. And so without any whistle that anybody heard, any kind of command, anything. Just all of a sudden, it went from night to day as the guns blasted out. What the state does, and this is the governor, he comes in and he says, we're going to shut everything down. We're not going to release anything. We're not going to say anything else on it. And as long as he lived, the state has never responded in terms of an investigation or allowing a Blue Ribbon Commission, any of that, to look into the Orangeburg Massacre. Now, the reason why it's a tragedy is that the Orangeburg Massacre is in 1968. And in 1970, you have Kent State. You have almost the same identical situation in terms of police officers on the campus who opened fire on students. We didn't learn anything from Orangeburg, and the reason why is because the students were black. And if they were, it had not been black, then there would have been some kind of investigation to find out what happened to the students or why they were injured. But the governor kept shouting about black power and black power advocates, and so he found me an easy target to blame everything on. So I was charged with several charges on the night of the 8th, 1968, felony charges that would have amounted to about 85 years in jail. But when I got to court, they had changed the charges down to 3 riot charges because there was no evidence. There was nobody. Even the police testified that they had seen me not on the night of the shooting, but on the night prior to the shooting as the other students were involved in demonstrations. And they had seen me out there, but they didn't see me violate any law. So what the state does is the state changed the date of my my crime from the night of the 8th to the night of the 6th. And they said that I went into a parking lot and I got up on top of a fire truck, flicked a Bic and said, burn, baby, burn. Well, that wasn't anything but rhetoric from Los Angeles. That's what they were doing. And there was no evidence. There was nobody out in that parking lot who saw me do anything that was a criminal violation. So the judge directed the verdict on the incitement and the conspiracy, because you need 2 people in order for you to incite somebody, and you need more than 1 person to convict on a conspiracy. So they ended up charging me with a one-man riot. Nobody else was ever arrested. And I went to court, found guilty, and sentenced to 1 year hard labor in the state penitentiary. And so I did what was 7.5 months, and the rest of the time was I got off because of good behavior. But later, 25 years later, the state did come in and pardon me. And I think one of the reasons why was that it wanted to kind of sanitize what was clearly a blister, and it was beginning to boil over. The governor made sure that under no circumstances, if anybody violated the policy and said anything that was derogatory about his administration or the police there, they would be pretty much drummed out of the state. And so nobody said anything about it. It didn't appear in the history books in South Carolina until the early 2000s.
Time for another break. This is MTSU on the record.
Tennessee's farm families contribute to our state's economy, nutrition, and culture. The Tennessee Century Farms program at MTSU's Center for Historic Preservation acknowledges farms that have been in the same family at least 100 years. To date, the program has certified more than 1,500 farms. There's no cost to nominate a farm or be part of the program. For all the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
We're with Dr. Cleveland Sellers, who is president of Voorhees College in Denmark, South Carolina. He'll be speaking on the theme of A Voice from the Movement February 17th here at MTSU as part of Black History Month. Let's talk about higher education now. How has the economic downturn affected historically black colleges and universities in particular?
It has been almost devastating to HBCUs because the HBCUs was an institution who had provided a quality education and ensured the necessary teaching to qualify low-income students to obtain the baccalaureate degree. And what we have now is that we have the kind of pushback about HBCUs, and that pushback comes from a number of things. One is that people start raising the question about the relevancy of HBCUs, and they argue that now that you have desegregation at all of the majority institutions, then and therefore you don't have any need for the HBCU any longer. But what they forget is that the HBCU has provided a tremendous service to minority communities and folk who want to go to an HBCU for the experience and the training, whoever they might be. The HBCU has never been discriminatory against anyone, and that we have been effective in training low-income students. And it is our thought that if we were not in existence, that would not assure that the African American community would continue to have an opportunity to get a quality education. 52% of your public school teachers, African American, 52% of African Americans come from HBCUs. And that's the statistics point out that the majority, 60% of your attorneys, their undergrad degree is HBCU. Students who come in as low-income students come from failing schools, secondary schools. So they are not going to be able to just show up on the college campus and all of a sudden master the 10th, 11th, and 12th grade, which the schools did not provide them with that kind of curriculum, and therefore they ended up with us. HBCUs are tuition-driven. We have been, over the history of the institution, expected to do more with less. We have mastered the ability to do that kind of thing, but when we start putting in blocks for poor people to come to school and obstacles for them to be able to matriculate in school because it's going to take a little bit longer, but you penalize the HBCU for being able to do that. I think the opposition is flavored by a very vocal opposition in Congress that don't want to see anything directed toward poor people, minorities, people who want to have the federal government assist in ensuring that as many of the nation's young people and students are educated as possible.
Time for one final break. We'll be back in a moment on MTSU on the Record.
The annual Baseball and Literature and Culture Conference at MTSU welcomes scholars from all over the country to present papers on numerous baseball-related topics. Their research highlights the national pastime's impact on everything from race relations to the economy and the sport's depiction in poetry and novels. The conference has attracted all-stars and Hall of Famers, including Denny McClain and Ferguson Jenkins. For the latest MTSU news and information, go to mtsunews.com.
I have to ask this question because it pertains to a recent development in our state. Tennessee Governor Haslam proposed in his State of the State address that community colleges and technical schools offer new students 2 years free of tuition and fees. which sounds great for students, but maybe not so great for four-year institutions. How does the idea strike you?
I am a old school kind of educator, and I think it's important for the student and the young person to understand that a four-year baccalaureate degree is going to be the measuring rod for the next generation of jobs that are developing and coming out. I don't have any problem with people going back to the community college and the trade and technical institutions, and that they can, in fact, get a two-year degree, which is equivalent to an associate degree, in some areas that might lead to some employment as a plumber, a carpenter, or the old trades. But unfortunately, those are, in fact, old areas. And so in order for you to develop the kinds of skills and to have the kind of experience that will help you matriculate in a highly technological global world, in a global economy, you have to get as much education as you possibly can. And I think the minimum requirement right now is a baccalaureate degree. So if you're going to get 2 years free, you also need to be need to know that you need to get 2 years that you're going to pay for, and go ahead and get all of that education that you possibly can while you can. And I think that's an incentive to get people in school, but I don't think that they get as much as they need to get in order for them to be successful 20 and 30 years from now, when the technologies will be all different and the jobs and the requirement for the jobs will be all different. And if you don't have that education, and I'm talking about a well-rounded education where you have the liberal arts, where you have the technical skills, where you have the STEM areas of concentration, you're not going to be sufficiently prepared.
Dr. Cleveland Sellers will be our Black History Month keynote speaker here at MTSU at 6 p.m. February 17th in the Honors Building Auditorium, talking about A Voice from the Movement. Thank you so much.
I'm glad to have an opportunity to speak with my students, and I look forward to our big rally.
MTSU On the Record, a news and information program about Middle Tennessee State University, is produced by the university's Marketing and Communications Office, which is solely responsible for its content. Read more about MTSU at our website, mtsunews.com. Podcasts of this program are available at mtsunews.com and on iTunes.